Hello there, Richard here. Being a walking tour guide means you're out in all weathers. The rain I can take. Up goes the umbrella. But did you know you lose a third of your body heat through your head, and when you are follically challenged, as I am, you can get jolly cold? I started to do walks in Oxford, and one day we were walking down by the river watching the rowing, and I saw a couple of young men wearing some rather nifty headgear. It looked a bit like a baseball cap, but thicker, probably made of wool to keep the chill at bay. I inquired at one of the gentlemen's outfitters in the town, and after explaining that I was not joining one of the college rowing teams, but just rather liked the look of the hat, a rather bemused sales assistant brought out a number of them for my perusal. They were mostly in bright colours, reflecting the different colleges, but there was just one of them in a solid red. Ideal, I thought. Certainly my walkers won't lose me in the crowds with this beacon in front of them. So that's why today you'll find me signing off as Richard Redhat. Anyway, in my last recording, I talked about a box of engravings that I'd picked up at auction. Today I thought I would tell you about another couple of pictures that were in this said same box. A while ago, friends of mine had recently been bequeathed a riverboat company on the Thames. I thought it might be an interesting idea to make use of their boats, which would allow me to create walks a little further from the centre of town. My original idea was to take a boat from the Tower of London down to Greenwich. What could be nicer than to travel on the river on an open-top boat, having a commentary on the way, and then have the delights of Greenwich as our destination for the walk? The reason I mention this is that my next engraving was of Greenwich Hospital. The hospital owes its foundations to the enthusiastic support of Queen Mary, who shared the throne with her husband King William III during the late 16 and early 1700s. The sight of wounded sailors returning from the defeat of the French had inspired her to urge the Treasury to hasten the grant of Greenwich as a hospital for seamen, to parallel that of the Chelsea Hospital for military pensioners, which had just been completed. Christopher Wren was commissioned as the chief architect, who brought with him Nicholas Hawksmoor as his personal assistant and chief of works, who was responsible for the daily running of the project, and Sir John Vanbrugh, a member of the board of directors who would later succeed as surveyor. By 1694, almost the entire site of the Tudor Palace of Placentia was granted to the project. This Palace of Placentia had been the birthplace of three Tudor monarchs, Henry VIII, and his daughters Mary and Elizabeth, but was now no longer lived in and in total disrepair. Although building was to take more than half a century, progress was initially rapid. The first 42 pensioners being accommodated in 1705, there were 350 by December 1708 and 1550 by 1755. But in the mid-1800s, it was decided to close the hospital. These vast, grand rooms were now thought to be unsuitable for these elderly inhabitants, as they were almost impossible to keep warm during the winter months. The buildings were then occupied by the Royal Naval College, but today it's the National Maritime Museum, the University of Greenwich, and the Trinity College of Music. In this engraving, you see the four large self-contained blocks being symmetrical across a central axis, which was dictated by Queen Mary's insistence that the hospital must not obscure the river view from the Queen's house, which is shown at the centre of the composition. This celebrated villa was begun in 1616 by Inigo Jones for Anne of Denmark, wife of King James I, and was completed in 1638 for Henrietta Maria, wife of King Charles I. The only viewpoint which affords a satisfactory frontal view of the whole complex, is that from the River Thames. So the artist set up his easel on the opposite bank of the river, which is known as the Isle of Dogs. This is actually a large peninsula, bounded on three sides by a big meander of the Thames. The name possibly comes from the Isle of Ducks, because of the number of wildfowl that used to be nestling on this marshy area. But by the 1500s, when Henry VIII lived in the Palace of Placentia, he started to keep his hunting dogs over here, and the barking of the dogs could be heard from miles around. Now, behind the main hospital buildings on the top of the hill, you can just make out the Royal Observatory, which was founded by King Charles II in the 17th century, who realised the importance of better naval navigation systems for the country's sea traders and explorers. Christopher Wren, at this time, was a professor of astronomy at Oxford University, and he was one of the advisers to the king and designed its first building. Later, in 1884 to be precise, Greenwich was to become where 0 degrees longitude is marked. And at the Royal Observatory, you can stand astride the prime meridian, meaning you can have one foot in the eastern hemisphere and the other one in the western one. The astronomer lived in the house next to the observatory, and in 1833 a ball was placed on top of his house which allowed the captains of ships to accurately set their chronometers before they set sail. The ball continues to drop at 1300 hours daily, which is, of course, 1300 hours GMT, Greenwich Mean Time. The dome now houses the enormous Great Equatorial Telescope, but at the time of this picture it was a smaller telescope, and the dome was actually made of paper mache. It's well worth a visit to Greenwich. There is just so much to see, not least as the Painted Hall, which was created as a dining room for the Greenwich Hospital. Today, beautifully refurbished, and I'm sure you'll recognise it from many films. But it's now time to return to the centre of London, and I'll tell you about my next picture, or should I say pictures, as although I hadn't realised it at the time, the subject matter of both these pictures are of a similar subject, but they happen to be on different sides of the river. I thought we might retrace our steps and go by boat. As we leave Greenwich, the river takes a couple of big swings to the right and left, but it's the area of Canary Wharf that dominates the landscape. This area of the old docks of London became redundant after the Second World War, and I remember as a teenager in the 60s being given a cine camera for my birthday and coming here to try it out. Even then, this callow and acne-ridden youth appreciated the amazing atmosphere of these redundant warehouses and docks. I eventually persuaded a couple of my friends during the long summer holidays to come with me to shoot a film down here. All I can remember about it is that there was a lot of chasing going on. Whether this was escaping the strong arm of the law or whether we were chasing the actual criminals, I'm not sure. I wonder what happened to that film. Anyway, today it's one of the main financial centres of the UK and, in fact, of the world, and houses some of our tallest buildings. But here comes Tower Bridge, which is a combined bascule and suspension bridge built towards the end of the 1800s and has become one of the famous landmarks of London. As we sail underneath the bridge, it always reminds me of the story of the bus driver driving his red double-decker bus who seemingly missed the traffic lights at the end of the bridge and drove over it while it was opening. He obviously realised his mistake, but decided it was too late to turn back, so revved up the engine and jumped the gap. That must have been quite some sight. We now pass the Tower of London to our right, still looking an imposing fortress after all these centuries, and pass under a number of bridges until we see the Palace of Lambeth on the left bank, and soon we will arrive at the setting of my next engraving. It was the site of the new Spring Gardens at Vauxhall. This was originally open to the public in 1661. Benefiting from the changing official attitudes to places of public entertainment, which took place after the restoration of King Charles II the year before. It was, however, inconveniently located on the opposite side of the Thames to where most people lived at the time, so visitors often had to be dependent for access on the notoriously bad-mannered watermen who would ferry them across the river. Although it proved popular for a short while, by the end of the 1600s it had closed down. A few years later, a resourceful entrepreneur, Jonathan Tyers, secured a 30-year lease on the site. He relaunched it in 1732 with an admission price of 1 shilling, and under his management the garden, with the enthusiastic support, I must add, of the ground landlord Frederick, Prince of Wales, and it enjoyed a period of sustained prosperity. On the 21st of June, 1749, for instance, the rehearsal of Handel's music for the Royal Fireworks was attended by 12,000 people, and London Bridge remained impassable for 3 hours as a result. Tyles' enterprise gained a significant boost, though, from the opening of Westminster Bridge in the 1750s, which meant the journey by carriage was considerably shorter. My engraving shows the view seen on entering the garden, looking east at the grand walk to the distant statue of Aurora. To your left is an avenue of trees, behind which there are various dining pavilions. In the forefront, ladies and gentlemen of fashion are parading and gathering in small groups. On the other side are the main buildings. The octagonal orchestra pavilion stands proud, and this is quickly followed by the organ house, and then the rather extraordinary Turkish dining tent. The gardens consisted of 7 acres of land laid out in walks. Initially, admission had been free, the proprietor making money by the sale of food and drinks. By Tyler's time, lavish musical entertainment was the order of the day, or should I say night. The dining boxes were filled with original paintings, many from the prominent artists of the day, but mostly, I must tell you, dashed off by their students and apprentices. The largest crowd ever to gather here was in 1786 at a fancy dress jubilee, which was attended by 61,000 revellers. Many of the best-known musicians and singers of the day performed here, but the garden's great attractions rose from being splendidly illuminated at night with about 15,000 lamps hanging among the trees. It was a place where people from all walks of life could mingle, and people of both sexes could meet and mutually serve one another as guides to lose their way. The turnings and little wildernesses were so intricate that the most experienced mother had often lost themselves in looking for their daughters. This mixing of the classes was to a certain extent their downfall. Another garden had recently opened, and this kept the riff-raff out by charging 2 shillings and 6pence, and this is my other engraving, Ranelagh Gardens. It was positioned just a little further up the river, but on the more fashionable side. Partly today it is the site of the Chelsea Hospital that I mentioned earlier. Ranelagh, which had a somewhat shorter life, occupied the former gardens of Ranelagh House, which had been built in about 1694 for Lord Ranelagh, treasurer of the Chelsea Hospital. The site was purchased by James Lacy in 1740 and developed by him as a garden of entertainment for a more discerning audience. For their 2 and 6 entrance fee, you were offered tea or coffee and bread and butter. But on firework nights, the entrance rose to 5 shillings. Its dominant attraction was the Rotunda, which is the subject of my engraving. This was built in 1741. Constructed entirely of wood, it had an internal diameter of 150 feet and two tiers of 52 boxes. Fashionable society could gather in this vast space, regardless of weather, to attend balls and masquerades, or listen to music, which was always played an important part in the entertainment here. It boasted a substantial organ, a band, and a choir. The central octagon was originally a bandstand, but in this engraving it has been replaced by a large fireplace, and the organ removed to the side. The young Mozart performed on this organ on the 29th of June 1764. Ranelagh initially enjoyed considerable popularity. Horace Walpole, son of the Prime Minister of the day, writing in a letter in 1744, "Every night I constantly go to Ranelagh, which has totally beat Vauxhall. Nobody goes anywhere else. Everybody's there. My Lord Chesterfield is so fond of it that he says he has ordered all his letters to be directed there too. You can't set your foot without treading on a prince or a Duke of Cumberland." Once again, there were walks and an artificial lake, so it was a popular venue for romantic assignations. Such was the renown of Ranelagh Gardens that similar ones opened in New York in 1765 and in Paris in 1774. Well, that's it for today. Someone got in touch to ask where I was going to hang these engravings. They are actually in my house in Suffolk. And if you'd like to join me again, I'll take you up there, show you around the village and take you into my house. Until then, keep safe. Richard Redhat, signing off.